Hello, welcome to the 29th episode of the Film Stage Podcast. I'm Jordan Ralph.
I'm Dan Mecca.
And this episode, we're going to talk about Jimmy Hayward's Jonah Hex and Lee Unkrich's Toy Story 3.
But two very different movies.
Yes. And even critic-wise, yeah, and box office-wise.
Literally every single one.
And every
very, very, very different.
Except they both have a Western.
Yeah, well, yeah, they both have cowboys, though.
Yeah.
And that's one. Got one.
All right. Well, let's jump into news stories first. First news story. A few days ago, we found out that Tom Tykwer.
Yep. Sure.
He is behind Run Lola Run, and most recently The International.
Yeah, and a couple of better movies in between, like Perfume and Heaven.
Yes, and and the next film he's planning, which we reported on at least a few months ago, was
Cloud Atlas.
Yeah, an adaptation of David Mitchell's novel. Have you read it?
No, I have not. Actually, remind me what it is about it, because I know it's very intriguing.
It's a project with six main characters that span thousands of years and several different genres. I'm not sure specifically, but that just sounds kind of...
Yeah, great. I mean, there's definitely something to it that reminded me a little bit of, ironically enough, something that Ayn Rand would write, like Atlas Shrugged or The Fountainhead, just kind of a wide encompassing, politically inclined kind of a thing, that obviously, accompanied, inputted some sort of fantasy element. And I say ironically, just because Atlas Shrugged went into production like a week ago with its huge $5 million budget and no name list of stars and Gossip Girl director. Or One Tree Hill director, sorry. But anyway, looking at it now, it looks
the six
vast.
Stories, it takes place like from 1850 and then it goes all the way to a post-apocalyptic future. So it's like... sounds crazy, and I would love for him to do a project like this. I mean, compared to something that felt kind of standard, with kind of a standard thriller.
The International. The International definitely was probably his weakest film. He hasn't made too many films, but that probably was definitely just something that clearly he didn't have full control over.
But the actual specific news story from last week was that rules for the film have been offered, which, I mean, doesn't mean much, but they're out there.
Well, it's nice to know people are getting it.
And Tom Hanks, Natalie Portman, Halle Berry, James McAvoy, and Ian McKellen have all been offered roles.
Yeah, it would be nice to see Tom Hanks in kind of a risky role. I feel like he hasn't made a movie in which he took a risk in a long time. I can't even really recall. I mean, I guess Castaway was kind of a risk, just because he was the only actor in the movie, essentially. But really, there hasn't been much lately from him. You know, those crappy Ron Howard,
Charlie
Dan Brown, adaptations, what I mean? Charlie Wilson's War, but I mean, even that, that's just kind of,
Not really.
Nothing much, so it's kind of, it would be nice to see him make a movie, especially with kind of an auteurish director like Twicker, who's, German, and he just has a very distinct style if you've watched his movies.
Definitely.
And I mean, Natalie Portman always seems up to the task of taking risks, and that's, I think, why what we really appreciate her as an actor. So, I'm looking at that. Wow, Halle Berry, James McAvoy.
I mean, I'm sure none of these. I mean, in terms of the stories, they don't really interconnect in terms of characters. So.
Right. Well, yeah.
So it'd be like a kind of a New York, I love you.
An Altman kind of. Oh,
an Altman thing. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So we'll keep you updated on that project. I'm sure it'll take a while to get off the ground, but
that's good that he's working on something.
Yeah. And not too many news stories this week, so just one more we're going to talk about. A few months ago, we reported that Clint Eastwood. Yes, was setting up a project. Dustin Lance Black, who wrote Milk, and he has his directorial...
Drugs Wrong with Virginia coming up, which he has directorial debut, wrote too.
And then Leo DiCaprio is attached to star, and now we confirm that he will be doing it for his next project, and it is... Hoover biopic.
J. Edgar Hoover, who was the first FBI director back in the early kind of 1900s. I want to go, checking into it now, but I want to go, 1920s, 1930s, and just really kind of the beginning of, obviously, because actually, if you guys have seen Public Enemies, that is the role that,
He founded it in 1935.
Okay, 1935. That's the role that, what's his name plays? What was I going to say? Billy Crudup.
It's Billy Crudup.
Before the FBI. So I think when he was going after Dillinger, he was in charge of police in Chicago, at least, or actually Essentially, I think it was almost like a U.S. Marshal Service, and that was like Christian Bale's character, Melvin Purvis, was his, like, you know, right-hand man and all that stuff. So, yeah, very controversial figure. You know, you have the whole cross-dressing thing. It's always been a big thing, and I guess it kind of would, it would make sense that a guy, a writer like Dustin Lance Black, who is, if you just look at what he's made, writing Milk, which is obviously about Harvey Milk, who's a first elected gay official, and then even What's Wrong with Virginia, which I actually got to, I had to watch an early cut of it a couple months back. That's a movie that's very much just about sexuality and growing up, and just kind of discovering your sexuality and living with sexuality and da-da-da. So, you know, Hoover, that part of that kind of dark secret in Hoover's past, or in Hoover's personal life, will be interesting to see portrayed by the guy who wrote Milk and What's Wrong with Virginia. So I'm kind of excited. And also, Leonardo DiCaprio. I don't think he's really played a role like that in a while.
No, I mean, the last biopic was Aviator. But
yeah, no, but I mean, like, even like even in that, the Basketball Diaries, for example, which is actually like a little biopic, there's like a sexual kind of thing with that is in turn with the drugs, and you know, when you go back. And it's an underrated movie. When you go back and you watch Leo in that role as just a vulnerable kind of victim of drugs and, you know, what he does for drugs. You know, he does kind of deviant sexual acts that he obviously, as a heterosexual male, doesn't want to do, but he does it anyway for drugs. I mean, that's a compromising thing. You don't see movie stars in a lot. So I wonder how far they'll go with the Hoover biopic, with Clint Eastwood directing, and we'll see. But
yeah,
definitely interesting. Yeah. You know, curious to see what they come up with.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's no news on when it will start shooting.
He said bangs him out quick, though. It's
expected shortly.
Yeah,
so
he gets him out there quick.
Yeah.
Grant Jr. had like a 25-day shoot or something. Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. It's a crazy thing. You know, so.
Yep.
Bangs him out.
All right, well, let's jump into news or film reviews.
Let's do it.
All right, so first review. Let's get it
best
over.
Best first. Jonah Hex. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, Jonah Hex. Let's yeah, let's get it out of the way.
Yeah. So Jimmy Hayward. Now he did.
Courtney
Here's Who.
Which I actually have never seen.
I have never seen either.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Wow. I thought that you'd seen it.
I thought I.
Wow. I feel bad now. Well, what do you know? Well, it was generally well received. I think one of the more moderate in every kind of single way entries into the DreamWorks, yeah. Into the DreamWorks canon of films. The Sony DreamWorks.
But then WB
or not Sony, gave him... what is DreamWorks? DreamWorks and who?
And,
because they're associated with someone else. But anyway, they, you know, not Pixar.
Yes.
Is the point. But...
Paramount.
Paramount. Jim Carrey was the voice of Horton, and Steve Carell. Horton was the elephant. Steve Carell was like the main who. You know, it made modest money, but this dude directed Jonah Hex. Why? It's a good question.
That is a great question.
Yeah, it's a good.
This is written by Mark Neville Dean and Brian Taylor, who we talked about last week. They're doing Ghost Rider,
right?
But
Ghost Rider 2.
Ghost Rider 2. It's The Spirit of Vengeance.
The Spirit of
Great title. And so they wrote this, and it's kind of, it's based on the DC comic.
Right.
That has a lot, kind of a solid fan base, but it's not really one of
the popular. Well, it's got a cult fan base.
Not really one of the popular
comics. Definitely.
And, so, I mean, this kind of had a lot of the right ingredients. You have Josh Brolin.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely had, what looked like a risky summer studio release, which you know, so even something along the lines of Splice, you know, like something where it's like, wow, I can't believe they're making that movie, you know, because you had like Josh Brolin playing the headline star. He's not really a movie star. I mean, he's a good actor, but you know, his only real, the only really headlining role I can think of is in W, which I mean, that was Oliver Stone's name, not Josh Brolin's name, but this is, you know, no name director. Josh Brolin as really your headliner, Megan Fox, in it. You know, the Neville Dean Taylor news was good because these are the people who did the Crank films.
Yes.
They did Gamer. And, I mean, you know, they're obviously polarizing films because they're not much by way of depth character-wise, but by way of visual, you know, ambition, they're very creative.
So what do you think of the movie? Do you think they delivered?
What's that? No, well, that's the point. Yeah, but the whole point being all these ingredients are, it just doesn't come together.
Right? No, yeah.
You know, it just totally, it seems like Warner Brothers kind of panicked a little bit.
Well, that you could tell even with, as soon as, you know, advertising six weeks we got the trailer.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly.
A lot of the insider, like, people just said Warner Brothers saw the film and just kind of...
Just forgot about it. Wrote it off. So that's what, you know, Deadline said that they wrote it off, which... I mean, obviously that is hearsay, because, I mean, there's no source backing that up, but watching, I mean, it's a 73-minute movie or however long, I mean, it's...
Without...
Yeah, it's 73 minutes just without credits. It feels long, you know. So I mean, it's one of those things where, I mean, clearly there were just sections of this movie that were taken out. Like, I mean, there has to be, because, on Film School Rejects, right? Our one of our writers, and one of Film School Rejects writers, Jack Giroux.
Yeah, if you check, you can check it on Film School Rejects. It's kind of interesting. It's all the stuff that was, you know, cut out of the film, not even shot. I mean, just from the script that didn't make it, not just from the comics.
I know he says this in his interview now. Jordan, help me with this. There was a point where Neville Dean Taylor was supposed to direct this movie.
Yeah, that's what he says.
I never read that story. I always thought it was one of those things where it was like someone else was always going to direct it, and then it was like, oh, Neville Dean Taylor got hired to write it, and I was like, oh wow, that's weird. You know,
yeah, now that it says it's incredibly paint by numbers and not the unique piece of craziness we would have gotten if Mark Neville Dean and Brian Taylor directed as intended.
Yeah, that's what I mean, and I thought that, I mean, you know, perhaps whoever it was, Brian Taylor or Mark Neville Dean, who told. And gave Jack the screenplay, but maybe he mentioned to Jack that, you know, at least within the studio, that was the original intention. Yeah. But I mean, someone made a good point on the comments of actually Jack's article. They said why Warner Brothers thought that the dude who directed Horn He's a Who would be a better fit for Jonah Hex than the guys who directed Crank is beyond me. Behind the scenes handshakes and, you know, one person knows another person. Obviously, that's how you're going to get jobs in this life, not just the film business, but any business. So, just, I don't know. I would just like to hear how Jimmy Hayward got the job, is the point.
I mean, they said WB was exploring the possibilities of Andy Fickman or McGee.
We are Hex.
Yeah, so. We are Jonah Hex. So, the film, yeah.
But back to the film. I mean,
it's a complete mess.
I definitely, based on the 15% Rotten Tomatoes reading, I was definitely expecting worse.
Yeah. It's not. I mean, I was never bored.
It's not unwatchable.
I wasn't really bored.
Yeah, but see, I don't know. See, I will say that I was bored. Like I did think? Get. Yeah, I mean, there are scenes that, like, that's what's weird. That is what's weird about this movie is it's so short, but there are scenes that are kind of, they're like a little long winded, and it's kind of strange because you're like, wow, this is, because you feel like, I don't know. It had me wondering. You know, for example, a movie like Cloverfield, which is almost the exact, I mean, Cloverfield was like 80 minutes, 75 minutes, I mean, it's very short, but that movie literally feels like they just cut out all the fat, so you have this like 75, 80 minute piece of just kinetic, filmmaking.
Yeah.
But this felt like, you know, 50 minutes of that, and then there was like 25 minutes of just kind of, it had me wondering why one scene was in the movie when there must have been something else shot that didn't make it. And so, I mean, obviously there's things, it's PG-13, it was originally intended to be R.
Yes.
You know, if you read Jack's, you know, little review comparison with the Neville Dean Taylor script, obviously the Neville Dean Taylor script was R, as you'd expect from the people who made, you know, the Crank movies and Gamer, which are very violent, ultra-violent movies. So, I mean, clearly the studio had something to do with that. You know, Megan Fox, Hooker with a Heart of Gold character, got a lot more play in the final product than I guess she did in the original draft.
Yeah, the original draft. It was actually cool. She was kind of like this, like older
right. Woman. She looked like, looked like, I guess, a hooker like that would look like. But, you know, like, truthfully, I didn't mind her in the role.
That was kind of the part I was fearing, because from the trailer, it's just kind of like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. Her accent's, you know, like, bad.
She plays a convincing hooker. I mean, she's a whore.
That's what I mean. I mean, yeah, like, okay, is she way too beautiful to be a hooker? Yeah, but so was the hooker in High Noon. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the original Hooker with the Heart of Gold. Like, that is the original. I mean, that is literally, that's a genre staple by now, that character. Mm-hmm. And that, I don't know her name, but the original woman who played the Hooker with the Heart of Gold in High Noon with Gary Cooper is gorgeous. And so, when you watch that movie, which is a masterpiece.
I just watched 2 weeks ago.
When you watch that masterpiece, even then, I remember my dad saying, when I watched it, I was like 13, I was like, wow, like, look how beautiful she is. So, I mean, I got past that, and I thought she was fine. And,
yeah. I mean, and, I think Michael Fassbender was a standout as a
The second henchman, or the henchman to John Malkovich's antagonist, the bad guy. Yeah, and he's horrible.
Yeah, he really is.
I mean, it's weird. John Malkovich, like, I would equate him to, like, a Ben Kingsley, where, like, this would be, like, this is Ben Kingsley in Prince of Persia.
Yeah.
You know, even though, but I even think that it's, I guess, worse. I mean, he's bad. Ben Kingsley is bad in Prince of Persia, but Malkovich is probably worse. I mean, this is, by a nose, a worse movie. Or, you know, maybe not even. I don't know.
I would say they're on the same tier. I would give them each around four. I'd say four out of ten.
Yeah. I don't know. It's tough to say which one's better.
Yeah.
Prince of Persia or Joan X. But,
No, and Will Arnett's kind of odd, really, really
odd.
Yeah,
bad casting. You know, like, I hate to hate on the Will Arnett, because, I mean, I think he probably really tried hard, but, it's just strange, you know, to see Job, just playing it completely serious is very weird.
Yeah. Then our main star, Josh Brolin, I think he did a fine job, but he could have...
I was surprised he didn't do a better job.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely was surprised. I mean, I liked the makeup for his face. I thought it was really good. I dug that, but like I was surprised. Yeah, I don't know why. I don't know, because he is, like, you know, when he played, for example, in W, his other lead performance. I mean, you know, say what you will about the movie, very flawed, but his performance is, I thought, a revelation. I mean, there were so many things going on. I mean, there were so many interesting angles to, like, his portrayal of our 43rd president, and just. It literally just gave you a lot to think about just the person, you know, and the caricature. And then in Milk, the same kind of thing. And then he's playing a fictional character. And it feels like he's playing it too close to the note. You know, it's weird. Like, he plays these real-life characters with this, like, creativity and this fervor. And then he's playing this guy who you could think you could do whatever the fuck you wanted because he's, like, this crazy DC Comics character. And he kind of plays it safe, it seems like, which is strange because we read all those news reports about articles about how this is, like, a very big passion project for him. And so I don't know what happened. You know, maybe he got caught up in something else or something. very surprised.
I mean, and then some moments I liked, I mean, just want to quickly
talk about. Go for it.
There's a train sequence early on, which actually has some beautiful cinematography in it. Like, there's the camera, there's a couple shots where the camera's panning across, tracking across the train, and there's one shot which I really loved it's on the track with the camera, or it's on the track of the train, and the train's coming at it, and the camera, like, flies back with the steam coming up right in the middle.
Oh, that was nice.
I really liked that shot. That nice. And Michael Fassbender in that scene was kind of funny, like, he was whistling as he was going to blow up.
Yeah, that was a good.
And then, like, the way they like, take over the train to steal the dynamite, and, like, they wear those, like, masks that you see in every horror movie now, and, like, they're pulling down, and I just like the way that was put together, and then there was, like, moments of, like, things that were awesome, like spoilers coming up. Michael Fassbender dies, and the way he dies is kind of awesome.
And then
another touch, the dynamite, like, gun. It should have been a lot cooler because it's a dynamite crossbow gun, but
that was cool. That was cool. He just literally blows 25 people away.
Yeah.
Sorry, keep going with what you liked about it. Go ahead.
The one scene which I thought they should have done more with is the creepy cage match with Michael Shannon in it for 3 seconds.
Yes, as the ring
leader. I didn't expect that. Because I know, and also, as Jackson in their review, there's, like, zombies in this movie that he, like, in the original script and stuff. And, like, stuff like that would have been cool. Because there's this, like, fantastical element where he can bring dead people back to life. And that idea itself is cool, but the way it's handled is kind of...
I mean, I thought there were some cool aspects to it. I mean, literally what he does is, he doesn't bring them back to life, but he summons them so they're alive to him, you know?
Yeah.
But what's cool is as soon as he starts doing it and he lifts them up from the ground, they start burning.
Yeah, the sooner they're dead, the quicker they burn.
And so, I mean, it's pretty interesting. The way they do that, you know what I mean? Jeffrey Dean Morgan plays Jeb Turnbull, who is John Malkovich's son, which is very strange casting. And also Joan Hex's ex-best friend, and through, they're fighting the Civil War together, and this is how the whole thing started. Joan Hex disobeyed a direct order from John Malkovich's character to, like, I guess, slaughter a village or something, whatever, burn a church down or something, you know, what always happens, you know, Mel Gibson, the Patriot style, and he turned it down. He ended up killing, you know, in turning him down, he ended up having to kill his best friend Jeb, who's Jeffrey Dean Morgan, and then Quinn Turnbull kills Jonah Hex's family, and that causes the revenge to get Turnbull, blah, 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 blah.
Which you will know by the end about 10 times.
Right, they, like, and that's the other thing that's so weird about it being 74 minutes long is that
10 minutes, are flashback.
10 minutes is, like, pounding it back in your head, like, literally recalling shots, where it's like, I do you remember that he got his family got burned.
And I think his face got scarred, right? Did you get that? Okay.
It was just, like, one of those things, very strange, like, oh, I don't know why that survived. And clearly, the Warner Brothers thinks that... Or Jimmy Hayward or whoever the editor thinks that the people who are watching this were just like hick retards.
And very over edited. At the beginning, there's like shots that like that look like long, nice kind of dragon shots. There's one on the coffin that comes back later. Yeah. And like they cut like I don't know if they didn't have the shot, but they cut like three times in that one long tracking shot to like it was really odd. I just noticed that in the beginning. Yeah, towards the end it gets better, but like and then there's that 10 minute or not 10, 5 minute like animation that is just
that was rough.
Really hated that.
That was kind of rough.
It looked like I could have done that in Flash. Like it wasn't cool. Like
I don't know. It wasn't that good. Yeah. I mean, I don't usually mind. Yeah.
Well, Kick-Ass did it really.
Kick-Ass do it?
Yeah, the Nicolas Cage backstory is all done in comic form.
That's right.
And that worked.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I guess I don't mind because as like an homage to like. The medium, you know. I don't mind that. I mean, even and this is funny. Like even in Ang Lee's The Hulk, which people had a big problem with the way he did that, where like there was literally comic strips, and stuff. I actually did not mind that in the film as a thing, as like a little style thing. Yeah. I mean, I just minded it because it was so poorly made. Yeah. But I mean, I'm just saying. So, but this, yes, just because it felt. The animation itself felt poorly.
They're like, "Oh shit, we didn't shoot any of this.
It felt like that. It felt like they did it 4 months ago.
And then one really like we aren't in spoilers, I guess.
Yeah.
The weapon that they're going after, it was kind of stupidly designed. I thought, like,
for sure.
Like
yeah.
They shoot six balls out, and then. They have one ball. Like, why can't you just
I didn't
have
really
the
get it. I didn't get why.
Well, here's the thing. Like, if you haven't seen the movie, which you probably haven't, because I don't think anyone saw it.
No.
There's this weapon that's, like, kind of the MacGuffin-ish, but they use it later, so I don't know. But anyways.
Yeah, it's the thing that everyone wants.
Yeah, and it's a rotating cannon with six barrels, this massive, and they shoot these... They look just like cannonballs.
It's like, they shoot, like, essentially cannons that are mines.
Yeah.
And then there's an orange ball that's the last one, of course, that shoots out. And it's, like, the one that blows up and triggers all of them. But it just begs the question, obviously.
And the reason that they couldn't complete their goal in the final mission is because they couldn't shoot out the orange ball, not because they got... So if they had...
Right, they
that
shot
thing,
out all the other
shot.
Cannonballs before. Yeah. And it's one of those things where you watch, you're just kind of like, well, why wouldn't you just make... One, like, because, and that's the other thing that's, like, it just, why wouldn't she just make, like, six orange balls?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, instead of, like, because then it'd be, like, because the other thing is, like, clearly the orange, it's not one of these things where, like, the orange ball is, like, the chemicals, and everything else has the detonation capability, because it's, like, the orange ball goes off and explodes, and then it, like, connects with all the other ones, like you would in a mine, you
well,
know,
I
like
thought
a mine
it was, like, it was more like it made those others blow up, so it was kind of dinner, but you know what I mean? Like,
No. But I'm saying that the orange ball itself blows up.
Right.
Because
right.
if you remember, that's how John Malkovich
right.
dies.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So the point is, if the orange ball itself blows up,
yeah.
then why not make six of them so you could just, like, launch, and it would just be, like,
and
it would
could
be literally,
right
like,
away.
Rocket launchers. You know what I mean? Like, so, even if Malkovich ultimately loses, they could have killed, you know, you know, 5,000 of, like, the black people who were at the thing, which was another horrible... That was a horrible subplot.
Yeah,
I hated that. The dude from the Wire played Smith, who I assume... I haven't read the graphic novels or the comics. I assume was a very cool character in the comics. He's, like, this weapons manufacturer who Josh Brolin knows, and he gets his Gatling guns, which, by the way, are in one scene in the movie,
which I didn't mind.
Yeah. I liked that.
It was a nice talking about the humor in the movie, because a lot of people thought it was just... There was
humorless.
No humor.
I laughed.
Yeah, I definitely laughed.
Yeah, I mean, I thought there were moments that were very well written, you know, like, there's some really nice one-liners. Yeah. I guess some people say that, like, Jonah Hex isn't a one-liner character, but, I mean, I'll say that I think that that's stupid. Having watched the movie, I think that he should have been. I mean, I don't know. He's a cowboy with a scarred face. He should have one-liners. It just kind of... But no, I mean, I think in the end, it's just a very messy, tame movie that has moments of kind of odd intriguing, you know, kind of splendor, you know, and you're just kind of like, oh, and then it's not there anymore, and then that's it. But just quickly, what I was going to, just to qualify myself,
yes,
there's this, with the Smith character, yes, from The Wire, he's this black guy, and obviously it's like back in the day, and they just have been awarded their freedom, da-da-da, all that stuff, and it's like this weird emotional pull they try to do, where it's like, he's with his sons, and they're listening to President Grant, played by Aidan Quinn, which is very strange, about, it's a centennial, yeah, it's the celebration, it's, yeah, so it's the 100th, you know, year celebration of,
which I,
of America, and it's like, the, and, but it's, you know, it's just like, wow, these balls are shooting off, because Malkovich's character is trying to destroy the Capitol,
yeah,
these, like, all these black people have gathered together to, like, celebrate their freedom, and also, like, the, and it's just stupid, because it's like, we don't care about anybody in this movie, like not, we don't care about Jonah Hex or, yeah, Megan Fox, oh, I, so, like, yeah, why would we care about this black guy, you know, who got one scene in this movie, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it,
yeah,
does, it's very strange. I don't know if that was, that wasn't in Jack's article. I don't know if Neville Dean Taylor had, like, a whole subplot about, yeah, that. That would have been very interesting, yeah, you know, obviously,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
the actor is very capable, but
yeah, the one thing I really like loved about this movie that was never fully explored, obviously, like a lot of things, was kind of the setting, like this Civil War, you know, and the like the Washington Monument was just being built, and like you never kind of see that, like you never,
yeah,
see movies,
no,
that,
yeah, they were cool, I, like, you know, I mean, and this is funny because I, when I saw the trailers, the first movie that came to my mind obviously was Wild Wild West,
yeah,
which,
yeah,
is, which is another just, I mean, far worse in every way disaster, just because it cost more and it was far worse and da da da.
Yeah.
But it was similar and like it was an interesting idea because it's like, oh wow, you're making a movie that's like, you know, it's like a Western, but it's an American Western, but it's not like a lot of Westerns where it takes place kind of in the land that time forgot.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, it's like, oh,
everything's desolate,
you know, like literally, it's just like it could be in 1820, it could be in 1880. You know, but this movie, I mean, just like Wild West, is very much just at a specific time, you know, a specific time in history, and it does suck, just like in that, yeah, other film, that they don't do more creatively,
yeah,
or just do more research.
I mean, more, even like, more of his, like, Civil War backstory would have been awesome.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah,
it's just,
I mean, the reenactments, you know, and as Jack rightfully mentioned in his review, the Civil War reenactment, I think there's only one, it's horrible.
Yeah.
It's all bad.
Yeah, if they kind of amped up, like, those supernatural things and started kind of
serious. I guess you could argue they needed more money, maybe, because, yeah, apparently it only cost $35 million, $40 million, yeah, but...
It doesn't feel... That's weird, because it doesn't feel like a cheap movie, but it feels like someone
it does,
cut
though,
out the...
It does kind of feel like cheap. I don't know. You know? Like, I don't know, it just... It's a very... It's like a beef... BBB
in
movie.
Terms of that, but I don't like some of the like production design and set. Like it, there was a mold, like it could have been great. Like kind of like,
yeah,
you kind of feel it, but it's not like all
it
there.
It just seems, oh man, just like it's just a shame. I mean, I don't know. I'll be honest. Of movies to fuck up, I'm not gonna lose sleep over. I don't think, you know, I like Neville Dean Taylor. I've liked all three of their films, Crank, the two Cranks, and Gamer. I have,
yeah,
but. Even if they had directed it, even if they had gotten a higher rating, even if they had gotten $20 million more dollars, you know, even if Megan Fox became an amazing actress and, like, Malkovich learned how to actually have an accent or something, like, even all that stuff, it still would have just been, you know, a crank-like, ridiculous thing in the West, which I don't really think we need right now in the world. So, like, I don't think that it would have been a big... It's a big loss, or it would have been a big... feet,
yeah,
anyway,
yeah, yeah.
But that said, obviously it does make you curious as to what it could have been, you know,
yeah.
So I mean, I think Josh Brolin, you know, whether he did it to himself or whether he got kind of bullied by Warners and Jim Hayward or what have you, he deserves a better platform film,
yeah,
and hopefully he'll kind of regain some of his rep with,
yeah,
like Wall Street 2 coming out, and even though I've heard he's in the You and Me, the Tall Dark Stranger, which got panned at,
yeah,
Cannes. So,
he has actually four movies coming out this year, which
does
is kind
he?
Of crazy.
Yeah. So apparently the Woody Allen movie, Jonah Hex, are the two to miss,
yeah,
and then True Grit and Wall Street 2 are the two to wait for.
And
then
we got MIB3.
Is he in that? Oh my god. Oh yeah, he plays the young. He's like
the young
main character, isn't he?
Tommy Lee Jones.
Because apparently Tommy Lee Jones isn't in it that much. Apparently,
yeah,
it's like Will Smith goes back.
Yeah.
Oh god, I cannot. Oh my god. I am so not excited for that movie. it is literally amazing how I'm not. Oh.
Well,
like, how bad, just quickly, how bad was MIB2? Like, do you remember seeing
it? Yeah,
that?
But Really? But I don't. I can't say. I remember loving MIB 1.
No, I love MIB 1 too.
I remember not as loving as much. But
I remember I think I saw the drive, and I remember just literally my mouth being open because I just was like, because that was another movie. It's like 85 minutes long. It's kind of like Jonah Hex, and you're just watching it, and you're like, how did all of these talented people just like decide that this was the best avenue to go? Like, to just do this. Like, this was a good idea. Anyway.
Yeah, that was it'll be 8 years. Jeez. Or it'll be 9 years.
Oh my god, that movie was so bad. Anyway, right. So hey, let's talk about a better movie.
Yes.
And that better movie is Toy Story 3.
Now, we both grew up, right? Toy Story, I think
that was one of the first movies. Yeah, VHS copy somewhere in my house. Yeah.
I mean, I had the Game Boy game. I had the Boys.
I had the first Game Boy game I ever got. N64 game.
You did, nice.
I don't know if I beat that game. I never really was good at beating video games, but I played it.
Yeah, that was the very first one. You were Woody jumping out of the boxes.
In the Toy Story, in the N64 game, you were Buzz.
Buzz, not still. Yeah, and so, 1995, I think that was.
Yes,
And then Toy Story 2 a little later, which didn't have much of an impact on me. Like, I remember, I rewatched Toy Story a lot, but I just recently watched Toy Story 2.
Yeah, I definitely agree. But I remember loving Toy Story 2.
Yeah, I love it. I watched it again, I love it.
Yeah.
And now we're back. Lee Unkrich.
Lee Unkrich, who...
He was an editor, which is kind of funny. Editor turned director.
But I mean, if you talk to anyone that knows anything about the Pixar movies, they'll tell you that really the way that the credits go, apparently it's very like, apparently it's very just kind of like, you know, whose turn is it this time?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, which I mean, hey, that could be hearsay. I don't know. Obviously, I don't know. But I mean, you know, like, Andrew Stanton directed my two favorites. So, did he? You know what I mean? I like to think so.
But
you know what I mean? So, that's kind of one of those things. But anyway. Definitely, Lee Unkrich was worthy. He was a worthy person to get the director title because this is reminded you, Jordan, of the first two movies and just what it's like to be young, and then also what it's like to be growing up and whirlwind of emotions.
Oh yeah, completely. And before I was thinking about the other Pixar films, and I think this one is the most wholly satisfying one.
Really?
Because I love, before this, WALL-E was my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And I love, I mean, the first 40 minutes of WALL-E, and I'm not the one of the person that thinks, it drops off and it's terrible the last half.
But I mean, understandably, it becomes less of a film. Yeah, sure.
And up on rewatching, first 20 minutes I love, and the rest is
good. It definitely, good. See, the movie that holds the most weight still to this day for me, and is a movie that I could literally watch right now, in 2 hours from now, even if we just watch it right now, I could watch it again in 2 hours. Finding Nemo. Finding Nemo.
That is probably
just in terms of just every aspect of a favorite movie, where it's like, you know, personal, like, oh, what's your personal, you know, Finding Nemo probably for Pixar is just my fucking.
And I mean, compared to the first two films, Toy Story, I mean, it introduced us to these great characters, a great adventure, but like that emotion and it's there, but it's not in this movie. It's like full on.
But it can be argued, and I believe this, that without the first one, the emotion obviously wouldn't be here in the third, because this is a very nostalgic, very almost like a retrospective in a way, almost like. At some point, it's like a greatest hits kind of thing, which I mean, obviously that is a criticism, but it doesn't have to be a bad criticism. I mean, they do it really well. It opens with another kind of imaginative scene from Andy's mind, which is really fun. Probably the best one I think they've done, of those.
I love how they just did it, because in Toy Story 2, it was a sci-fi with Buzz, and now here is like a Western and you bring in like all the characters.
This was like literally like an all-encompassing thing, like this movie is.
Yeah.
And then it cuts out, and it's a video of when Andy was younger, and obviously, you know, as someone who grew up, you know, with the first movie, you're like, oh my god, like there, you know, I remember that. And then, so I mean, obviously, initially it does feel a little cheap, because you're like, oh, okay, you're gonna like play off our emotions, but. I mean, it's a sequel. It's a second sequel, so I think definitely it reintroduces us to the characters, reestablishes, you know, why we love them in the first place. I think it's very smart. And then you have just a lot of little nice little, like, little, you know, tidbits that remind us, you know, for example, you know, they mentioned Bo Peep at one point. Yeah. You're just, you know, very sad. You're like, oh, Bo Peep, like, I remember from, you know, the first two films. And there's a really great joke with the dog.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, so they're so these reflective jokes, though obviously they wouldn't live without the first two movies, carry on their own kind of
way. I mean, that's the thing with, like, a lot of people said, you know, oh my god, it's been 10 years. Like, are they, I mean, are we going to care about these characters again? And, like, I think if this movie came out in 2004, 2005, it wouldn't have the same impact. I don't, like,
I mean, I wonder.
Because back then, you know, I was just leaving high school and that. I don't know, in terms of our age
group. Well, for us.
For us, yeah. But I mean, for everyone else, I don't know.
I mean,
but,
you know, like, for me, you know, for me and you, I think a big part, I mean, this movie affected me, you know, because we just graduated college, and now it's, you know, we're literally moving on to, you know, probably the biggest separated step of our lives, where it's literally school for 21 years, 22 years, and then something else. So then when you watch something like Toy Story 3, where it just, I mean, even though obviously, and we'll talk about this later, there might be a future for these characters. This very much feels like, you know, some sort of a bookended thing. Oh, so you watch it, and it does feel like the end of an era, an era. And
I mean, even the shots, exactly, the clouds. That's the
hell. Right, at the end, right, yeah. The clouds. Okay, yeah, obviously. Like, but so, I mean, stuff like that is just very, for our age group, who, I think we were probably around, I mean, the age group that really hit, Toy Story hit first. I mean, we were 8, when Toy Story came out, you know, so. But it was funny, I watched a trailer, on Rotten Tomatoes, you know, they just went down all the Pixar movies. And I cannot believe this is only the 11th Pixar movie. It feels like they've taken over the world with so much more than that. But
yes.
But I watched the Rotten Tomatoes put up the teaser for the first Toy Story movie, and I watched it, and it just, like, literally just reminds you of how great that first movie is. Just, there's so many scenes in that first movie that are just so, like, iconic.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if this film will have the same shelf life, you know. I don't know, what do you think? Like, obviously films like Bug's Life and Cars and, you know, I'm trying to think, even Monsters, Inc. don't have, I mean, they're loved by men. Yeah. You know, Cars is loved by a lot of people, obviously, that aren't our age. You know, kids should probably react to Cars the way we reacted to Toy Story, but they don't have the same.
I mean, I think, like you said, the third movie comes with the first two. It's not like, and I think, as a trilogy, it is, I can't think of a better trilogy. I was trying to think. Like,
but yeah, that's a good point.
Like,
is there a better trilogy?
I don't know. Each movie, like, both, they each stand on their own.
Is it Die Hard?
Star Wars.
Star Wars is, I mean, I would say on a similar level of, you know, it's very much an entertainment thing. Mm-hmm. It's, but I mean,
Return of the Jedi. And throw,
I guess this is definitely a more satisfying.
Thank
second
Godfather.
Sequel.
No, I'm trying to think, you know.
Well, the third, yeah, the third one, yeah. That's interesting. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, I mean,
the Bourne trilogy.
Is no, but I never. I mean, the motion that Toy Story 3 get out of me is.
I mean, obviously, comparing oil and water, but I mean, but still, I mean, the Bourne trilogy is fucking good.
It is.
But yeah. I guess this is probably the best trilogy. Yeah, it's an interesting point.
And and in terms of, like, the new characters, if you want to talk about that for a little bit, the
did it perfectly, I thought.
Yeah, because you know, a lot of these threes, you know, Spider-Man and stuff, and other three
packs
are just. Yeah,
I mean, even Iron Man 2.
Yeah, Iron Man 2.
Batman and Robin.
And with this, each character has, like, I mean, some moments are small, but they each have, like, just something that's so memorable. Like, if you name a character, I can immediately come up with what they did and what I loved about them, and handled so well. Some highlights, if you want to go, like Mr. Pickle Pants.
Love it,
and he's
absolutely love it. Like a Kenneth Branagh spoof in a Richard, like, the Lionheart esque toy, you know, like voiced by the perfect dude to spoof Kenneth Branagh, Timothy Dalton, you know, who spoofed himself in Hot Fuzz. You know, so literally you can tell they did their research, you know, Pixar, obviously, then, with the voice decisions there. So.
And then the FBI informant, like, phone, like, the
old school. Oh, God, so funny. I forgot about him. I can't remember who did that voice, but he look it up. He's good.
And, I mean, Ken was a big, he was one of the bigger new
Ken,
characters.
Yes, Michael Keaton, yeah.
And, Yeah, and I mean, there's so many. I mean, what do you think now? The villain, I guess, spoilers coming up.
Yeah, spoilers. You know, obviously,
I think everyone
totally recommends seeing
it. Yeah, absolutely,
you,
see
you know,
it.
If you're listening, you probably saw it already, but totally see it. I mean, especially if the first two Toy Stories were a part of your life, or if you have kids, or you have nieces, nephews, or brothers and sisters who have not been exposed to it yet, this is definitely worth, you know, taking them to go see.
And even if it wasn't part of your life, I know I actually
was saying, weird.
A few people that, I mean, I know haven't even seen the first two. I mean, I would just say get those first two, watch them, and then watch this. It's like a perfect
Trilogy. Oh, just a good, could be a great weekend for you.
And yeah, so the villain,
Lotso.
Yeah. Lotso Huggin Bear.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, a lot of people have said that, he was kind of like the prospector in the second. He's kind of like this nice, really older, friendly, and then he kind of turns at the end. And I mean,
which is true.
Yeah.
But obviously, the big difference is, and I'm pretty sure this is true, the prospector didn't have really much of a backstory.
Yeah.
And Lotso has. I mean, a big part. I mean, his character is his backstory, which is, you know, he was once the most loved toy of this girl, Pearl, and one day, their family went on a picnic, and the parents forgot the toys, like, on the blanket, and they had to, like, walk, and, you know, so the toys obviously made this huge journey back to the house, and by the time they got back, Pearl had already bought, her parents had bought Pearl a new Lotso.
You know what?
And you, Jordan, were saying you didn't like it that much. That was one of your least favorite parts of the movie.
Yeah, I don't know, something about that, like, I just feel like that theme is already, like, it wasn't surprising that, like, he would.
Yeah, and I agree. It's not surprising. Yeah. It's very
One
easy.
One thing I thought would have been awesome would be to kind of get the feeling that, like, these toys have such a long life, is they, that journey that they took, they came back, and it was the daughter of the girl they grew up with. Like, that would have been mind-blowing. Because, like, the movie has this, like, kind of thing where, like, in the beginning they talk about this attic, and it's like, we're going to go up there, kind of this, like, heaven. Well, first they paint Sunnyside as this, like, heaven area.
Of course.
And then they paint this attic. And first they said, like, well, like, our goal is to go to the attic and kind of live there forever, and, like, we'll have board games and stuff. And it's kind of, like, the sad thing that, like, we'll be with our friends, but which this film explores. So we can talk about that later, the friendship thing. But like, but they're gonna go up to Andy's attic and just these what 10 toys probably by now. We'll just live together forever.
Yeah.
And like, and what I would have loved to see, kind of to even expand on that, would be to have that Lotso character make this huge journey and have. I mean, I don't know how far away they went for a picnic, but which is kind
well,
of
like, but still,
but, I mean, but to have it like be like, oh wow, there's a whole another generation and like. Like,
well, see, that's what I, but like, in kind of in a reverse way, I did like that they did this was, I mean, like you're saying, it's about friends, but, and obviously these are just toys, but what's nice about it is just, I mean, you know, it just, it puts it in perspective, obviously, that, you know, how we as humans, you know, treat things, but also, if you want to kind of get down to the toys level and use them as metaphors for friendship, which the movie also does, it also puts into perspective what it means to be, like, a good friend, right? And so you have, for example, Lotso, he goes back, and he's been replaced. And it's for a moment, it's eye-opening for me, at least, because it's, like, it reminds you, it's like, wow, these are just toys, you know, and you can just literally buy a new one. And, like, that's sad that if in real life, like, they had feelings, isn't it so sad that we as people just kind of regard them as just tools, you know.
Yeah.
But on another end, Lotso, if you get down to his level, it would be, you know, like a betrayal of a friend, you know, to go so far out of your way to do something good for a friend, to get back to a friend or something, and then to have it be to just be blindsided like that. So you have another end of the spectrum, whereas obviously with the toys, the main toys, you know, the Woody and the Buzz toys, they will forever represent the, you know, solidarity of friendship. So just lots of kind of plays the other side of the card. So I thought that really worked well because it kind of does remind you that there is a darker side to Oz kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I think it worked. It was definitely easy, and that your idea of longevity would have been interesting. I thought of that too when I was watching. I just thought of, like, you know, like, wow, like, you know, Woody, you know, how long is Woody going to be played with
for
the rest of his, you know, is Woody just going to be this, you know, like, crappy toy, you know, in, like, 50 years, that, you know, it's just very interesting.
Oh, just talking about Lotso, what do you think about his, I mean, towards the end, this can lead us to the friendship thing, but the toys are in this trash. They go to this trash, or garbage landfill, and they're kind of on this like track to their doom.
To their doom.
Fire. And Lotso, Woody saves Lotso from dying or getting cut up, yeah. And then Lotso goes to almost save them, and then he turns back. And,
yeah, well, it's like Woody saves Lotso, and then Lotso climbs up a ladder to save all of them by stopping the conveyor belt by pressing a button. So he gets up to the button, and then he looks at Woody and all of them, and he doesn't press it.
Yeah.
And it's like...
I mean, because one reviewer that didn't like it said this movie is, like, just kind of mean and, like, sad, like, in terms of that.
Yeah.
And Woody, I mean, did you... I like, thinking back at that, like, that... There's no moment of redemption on that, like... You know what I mean? With
Lotso dies, though.
That's true. Well, he's on the front of the car forever.
Oh, true. Okay,
so he doesn't even die, and it's like... I don't know, like that moment was so mean, and like you kind of feel like there would be a
yeah, but see, like I like that because yeah, this movie it's does have this like such like dark I was saying tone, before, it's got a dark edge. Like, of course, Lotso would betray these friends of his because like he got betrayed, and he's like this lower class of toy, you know, just like there are lower classes of people that you know literally. Like, what does friendship mean to you?
Yeah.
You know, like obviously there's a code, you know, like you know if Woody. He's going to save your life. Obviously, you're going to stop the conveyor belt because that is the way that it works. That's the way that life works. And Lotso doesn't live by that code because, you know, Pearl or her parents or whatever didn't live by that code. So, I mean, you know, I mean, yeah, but it's definitely meaner than the first two.
Yeah. And then it led to that scene, which it's like one of the best scenes I've, like, very animated sad, movie. Very sad. Yeah, so if you haven't seen it, I don't know why you're still listening, but we can talk about it. These toys, Lotso doesn't push the button. They get thrown into this...
Right, into the... To get
kind
burned
of just,
up.
It's kind of just
in an inferno, yeah, essentially.
And so beautifully animated, like the fire. Oh my god, it's just so... This whole movie is just so visually impressive. We can talk about that next.
Wait, but how did they end up... how did they end up not dying again?
The claw.
Oh god, I love that. No, I but did love that.
Moment,
I did
like,
love that.
I think everyone in theater was like... Is picked? Are we
for a minute?
Yeah,
end? For about
like,
a minute.
It's a really extended scene where you know slowly Jesse holds Buzz's hand. The potato heads hold it.
I told you what I thought. I thought that Woody wasn't going to hold their hands, which I don't know why I thought that. I guess like, well, I guess
he already kind of does it.
But see, doesn't it show how invested you are just like with the characters that like I literally thought like I was like, well, Woody would. You know, like, Woody's going to save him. Yeah. Like, that's literally, like, what I was thinking in my head.
Like, just think about it. Like, these are all animated by Pixels.
Oh,
and, like,
God,
it's, like,
gonna
it's
cry.
Unreal how much cry. Pixar can make this feel. And, like, and so slowly, like, these toys, they start holding hands, and, like, they
and
just
then when
accept,
Woody, and then, like, when Woody finally holds Buzz's
hand,
and then it's, like,
the
oh.
look on his face.
And, like, literally everybody in the theater, like, I was just, like, oh, fuck. You know, because, like, Woody, like, Woody's the last, you know, he's, like, the last.
And, like, I mean, my heart was, like, boom,
God,
boom.
Dude, that was so sad.
And it just gives you the sense, like, these toys, like, even wherever they go, they, like, are best friends. And, like, it totally, like, it, like, even in your own life, like, just thinking about friendship, I was like,
oh, man, I know.
It's, like,
I know. It really was affecting. It was really, I mean, totally.
And then the claw comes down, and it's a nice throwback even to the early thing. Like,
yeah,
say
that's
the claw, and it's like,
right.
Like I've never was like,
oh my god,
and from that, I mean, from that moment on, the movie is just like brilliant. Like the whole ending sequence,
it's good. Yeah,
talk about that.
Just...
So they go, they escape the landfill, they go back home, and in another like this movie is just like the last three scenes are just like. So
just heart wrenching,
yeah, and one scene that I love it. One of the first times Toy Story has ever kind of had human only interaction. You know what I mean? Like
mm-hmm,
only human,
mm-hmm.
like Andy and his mom, is she's finally saying goodbye, and it just like hit me like you know we're going like we're out of college now, and it's like, you know, after this moment, like Andy will you're never the same with your family. I feel like after you leave college, like you know what I mean. Like you're still in my
well,
love.
Home, yeah.
After
he's going to college.
That's what I mean. Sorry. Yeah, after you go to college, and it's just like we've seen him kind of grow up, like for these 18 years.
Yeah.
And, like,
No, I mean it's definitely. And then you have this, you know, at the end he. Oh God! Like at the end, just the scene that really got me is at the end of the movie he, they all make it back into the box, for the attic. And then, but then what Woody does, of course, is he writes an address, like, on the top of the box. And so, Andy decides to take, the box to this address, which is of this other girl Bonnie's introduced earlier. He's this like girl who's like really good with her toys.
It was odd that I was like, why are they like when that scene happened when we introduced her? I was wondering why they spent so much time with her, and then I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, that was kind of an odd scene
in the beginning. Yeah. But yeah,
and no, and then so and then Andy brings toys, and Woody ends up because Woody's the only toy that Andy's going to bring to college. Woody ends up deciding to go to like sneak into the Bonnie box, and then. And then Annie's giving her all the toys, and then Bonnie like sees Woody who she's previously met, and like and then grabs him, and like Andy doesn't want to let go of him, and that scene, that like that moment where this kid kind of has to realize that like he's got to let go of even like Woody, who's obviously been around like since the very beginning, that's very sad. And then like he lets go, but like not before he plays one more time with him.
Well, it's so good. I mean, the whole movie is about like, is Andy ever going to play with us again? And then at the end, totally like, just
satisfaction.
Just
one more time.
Yeah, and yeah, you just get this moment of like Bonnie and Andy just playing with these toys for the final time, and it really is like a satisfying ending.
It definitely just like you said. I mean, it puts a lot of things in perspective. I mean, we were only at that point of going to college 4 years ago, and it kind of just you're right. It reminded me of just that separation, be it toys, be it anything, just be it home, be it just those things, like be it the family room, I think like for me, like one of the big things about leaving, it sounds stupid, but like one of the big things about leaving home for me was like just the comfortability that you have with just things in your house. For me, the couches and the family room, just the way that looked and all that stuff, and then you lose that. So everybody has something like that. And then to have him one more time go back and just like recall it before going back, before going to school and starting a whole new frontier of life, like, I mean, just really affecting, and I think it's very universal. And
yeah, I mean, it's one of the most like genuine, just like anyone gets to feel, go through this movie and just get something amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, I can't imagine, and see, movies like this always make me think, how would I react, assuming I watch this movie 10 years from now, how am I going to just react to the problems, because, like, the subject matter is universal. Yeah. So, for example, I'm graduating college now, so obviously when I see, like, the separation and this moving on, I relate it directly to this change in my life, but 10 years from now, is it going to be... what is it going to be? I'm saying that it's going to be something. And that's the point. Like, you could be 75 and it could be about, dying. It could be about literally how, you have to kind of just, before you go back and find those things in your life that made it worth it and and all that stuff. And I think that at any point in your life that you could have that. So I think that's just something you don't see in movies a lot. Animated movies. I mean, something you just don't see in movies a lot. So I think that kind
of... And even if none of that, like, let's say none of that relates to, there's still this thrilling kind of escape plot that harkens back to, like...
Of course.
Every great escape movie.
I was going to say, I was surprised, and maybe I just haven't watched the first two Toy Stories in a long time, but I felt like the film references in this movie were just abundant, and I'm not saying that's bad.
There are a lot. There's a ton.
I'm sure there's a ton.
The Jurassic Park one in Toy Story 2 when he's like...
Yeah, true.
But you're right.
There's from the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari to The Great Escape, there's just a thousand, things, but, a very blatant one is the bridge on the River Kwai with Potato Head gets boxed in the sand. It's not a sandbox, it's a litter box.
Well, I think it's a sandbox, but there's like
really?
Children are poop. Yeah, it's definitely a sandbox because why would there's no litter, there's no like animals. So like it's a sandbox, but they poop. There's like poop.
That's a gross sandbox.
Yeah. No, I know. That's the thing. That's the whole.
You had to clean that sandbox.
The caterpillars.
The Lincoln Logs.
But because of the children and the caterpillars.
Yeah, all the kids. Yeah, yeah.
The movie's hilarious. Like, there's, I mean...
Yeah, a lot, of, just a lot of...
Everything.
Ken, the whole... I mean, obviously a very easy joke, but a funny joke. The whole... the ambiguous sexuality of Ken.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because, obviously Ken, the doll, doesn't have a penis, and that's always a big thing. So in the movie, he's gay, but he's gay. He's not really gay. I mean, that's very, very, I think, well done, because they don't... It's not really exploitive, It's not exploitative. It's not... They're not... like, oh, he's a fag. You know, it's kind of like, oh, he's like a metrosexual, yeah. Or is he homosexual? You know, that's funny. It's funny.
And a few visual moments, like the because a lot of this movie, obviously, because there's toys, there's a lot of close-ups of just them interacting and stuff. But then there's these moments like where they pull back for a wide shot, and like everything's like lit and animated so beautifully. Like one of the Buzz, there's a shot where like Buzz is approaching a vending machine, and like I just something that like struck me the way it was lit. And the there's a shot where Woody is at Bonnie's house, and like they're sleeping, and he has to get up and walk across the bed, and it kind of pulls back, and you see like the whole room, and even the kind of like video game esque like shots of Sunnyside, like where they're entering the room and like the camera's like panning around, yeah. And it's just like wow. And then one of the other things that they didn't do in Toy Story at all was the slow motion shots. Like there's one where Andy is getting played with genuinely for the first time with Bonnie, and like Woody, and like she throws him up in the air, and he kind of like flies in slow motion, mm-hmm. And, like, and you kind of get this moment where he's like he finally happy. Gets happy, yeah. And then. And there's just like a kind of a funny slow motion shot with Ken, like at the dress up, and he like the camera when he like at the very last thing he dresses up with,
yeah,
him,
yeah.
Like, the camera kind of flashes, and he has like the cowboy like twirl things.
So, yeah. I mean, I like.
And there's just like little like touches that you don't see in any other anime.
You know
what's
weird? Buzz doesn't do any like flying feats or anything in this one.
Yeah, he does the he gets up into that the room's locked, and he gets up into the He goes across the line and he gets up into above the door, the window thing. Right, but it's not like, yeah.
I don't know. I always from the first two movies, it just seems like they're these like impossible feats. Well, obviously the famous one from the first one. But anyway. Didn't Toy Story 2 is a lot more buzz based because the whole father thing,
the whole Zurich thing. Yeah. And there's a crazy feat, the one where he has to rush because they're leaving. Because I just watched it. Al's toy barn. Al is leaving with all the toys, and he has to get to the door, and like he jumps. He like has to make his way like all the way up top to the thing. Anyway, it's just this huge like action feat.
But doesn't it say something about this third movie that doesn't have anything like that? But it's still just as satisfying. I don't know.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting. Maybe.
It's more like a team thing.
It seems like it's more. It's almost a compliment to it. Like,
yeah.
It's almost grown. You don't have to rely on these like kind of these. One or two really exciting characters because we all now appreciate all the characters kind of almost on like an equal plane.
And what do you think? The one thing was that they formed this plan. They must be the smartest people in the entire world because they formed this plan and it worked on the first try. Everything. I always wondered about that. The plan they get. Woody's like, "All right, guys, I have a plan," and then it fades to them coming in a circle, and then the next scene is them doing the plan, and everything works literally perfectly.
Yeah.
But it's just funny. Like you never see that in like the Ocean's movies or something. Like something always goes wrong, and there's nothing goes wrong until they get to the Lhasa there.
Lhasa, God.
And then dude, when he comes down and hits that garbage, like you're like, damn it, they were so
close. Damn it, Lhasa. Damn it.
Yeah, but no, we can wrap this up if you want.
Go see it. Live your life.
Yeah, one of my absolute favorites of the year, and I can definitely see it.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I can't see. I mean, I don't know what animated movie will even contend. I can't even.
I mean, How to Train Your Dragon was great, but I think this movie.
Yeah, oh, right, right, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. So,
that's the only one.
But, I mean, definitely just a great, time at the movies.
Yeah, so absolutely go see it. All right, and then next week we'll be back. We saw Night and Day, which is really fun. So if you're listening to this, go see it.
Yeah, go see it early. Yeah,
full review.
We'll do a little podcast.
And then Grown Ups screening. So
We'll see how that turns out.
Yeah. All right. Well, follow the Film Stage for all news updates. And you can follow us on Twitter. You should know it by now. So.
Yeah.
All right. And email us questions if you want. editors@thefilmstage.com.
Yeah, definitely do it.
All right, guys. See you next week.
Have a good night.